how everyone had laughed, how he himself had laughed as he came out dripping, with his bottle of beer still in one hand, too drunk to know what was happening, that the flushing sound he heard was the remainder of his reputation going down the shitter. Yes, sir, and yes, ma'am. There he had been on that hot day in Los Angeles, laughing like mad in his wet Pierre Cardin suit, bottle of Bud upraised in one hand like a trophy, everyone else laughing right along with him. They were all having a great old time. He had been pushed into the pool just like in a movie, and they were having a great old time. Hardy har and heidi ho, welcome to the wonderful world of Too Drunk to Know Better. Let's see you write your way out of this one, Marinville. He felt a burst of shame that was more for himself than for Tom, although he knew it was Tom they were looking at, except for Mary, who was still making a big deal of her wrist. Tom, who was still saying, "Give me that back," while he clenched and unclenched his hand like baby fucking Huey. Tom, who was already shot on only three drinks. Johnny had seen this before, too. After a certain number of years spent swimming around in the bottle, drinking everything in sight, and yet seeming to remain almost stone sober, your booze gills had this weird tendency to suddenly seal themselves shut at almost the first taste. Crazy, but true. See the amazing late-stage alcoholic, folks. Step right up. You won't believe your eyes. He put an arm around Tom, leaned into the brown aroma of Dant that hung around the man's head like a fumy halo, and murmured, "Be a good boy now, and you can have that shot later." Tom looked at him with his red-laced eyes. His chapped, cracked lips were wet with spit. "Do you promise?" he whispered back, a conspirator's whisper, breathing out more fumes and running it all together. "Yes," Johnny said. "I may have been wrong to get you started, but now that I have, I'm going to maintain you. That's all I'll do, though, so have a little dignity, all right?" Billingsley looked at him, wide eyes full of water, red lids, lips shining. "I can't," he whispered. Johnny sighed and closed his eyes for a moment. When he opened them, Billingsley was staring across the stage at Audrey Wyler. "Why does she have to wear her damned skirt so short?" he muttered. The smell of his breath was strong enough for Johnny to decide that maybe this wasn't just a case of three drinks and you're out. Old Snoop Doggy Doc had chipped himself an extra two or three somewhere along the line. "I don't know," he said, smiling what felt like a big false game show host smile, and leading Billingsley back toward the others, getting him turned away from the bar and the drink sitting on top of it. "Are you complaining?" "No," Billingsley said. "No, I just..." He looked nakedly up at Johnny with his wet drunk's eyes. "What was I talking about?" "It doesn't matter." A game show host's voice was now coming out of the game show host's grin. Big, hearty, as sincere as a producer's promise to call you next week. "Tell me something. Why do they call that hole in the ground China Pit? I've been wondering about that."
"I imagine Miss Wyler knows more about it than I do," Billingsley said. But Audrey was no longer on the stage. As David and his father joined them, looking concerned, Audrey had exited stage right, perhaps looking for something else to eat.
"Oh, come on," Ralph said, unexpectedly conversational. Johnny looked at him and saw that, despite all his own problems, Ralph Carver understood exactly how the land lay with old Tommy. "I bet you've forgotten more local history than that young lady over there ever learned. And it is local history, isn't it?"
"Well, yes. History and geology."
"Come on, Tom," Mary said. "Tell us a story. Help pass the time."
"All right," he said, "but it ain't pretty, as we say around here."
Steve and Cynthia wandered over. Steve had his arm around the girl's waist. She had hers around his, with her fingers curled in one of his belt loops. "Tell it, old-timer," Cynthia said softly. "Go on." So he did. 2.
Long before anyone ever thought of mining for copper here, it was gold and silver, Billingsley said. He eased himself down into the wing chair and shook his head when David offered him a glass of spring water. That was long before open-pit mining was thought of, either. In 1858, an outfit called Diablo Mining opened Rattlesnake No. 1, where the China Pit is now. There was gold and a good bit of it. It was a shaft mine. Back then they all were. And they kept chasing the vein deeper and deeper, although the company had to know how dangerous it was. The surface up there on the south side of where the pit is now ain't bad. It's limestone, skarn, and a kind of Nevada marble. You find wollastonite in it lots of times. Not valuable, but pretty to look at. Underneath, on the north side of where the pit is now, that's where they sank the Rattlesnake shaft. The ground over there is bad. Bad for mining, bad for farming, bad for everything. Sour ground is what the Shoshone called it. They had a word for it. A good one. Most Shoshone words are good ones, but I disremember it now. All of this is igneous leavings, you know. Stuff that was injected into the crust of the earth by volcanic eruptions that never quite made it to the surface. There's a word for that kind of leavings, but I disremember that one, too. Porphyry, Audrey called over to him. She was standing on the right side of the stage, holding a bag of pretzels. Anyone want some of these? They smell a little funny, but they taste all right. No thanks, Mary said. The others shook their heads. Porphyry's the word, Billingsley agreed. It's full of valuable stuff, everything from garnets to uranium, but a lot of it's unstable. The ground where they sank Rattlesnake No. 1 had a good vein of gold, but mostly it was hornfels, cooked shale. Shale's a sedimentary rock, not strong. You can snap a piece of it in your hands, and when that mine got down 70 feet and the men could hear the walls groaning and squeaking around them, they decided enough was enough. They just walked out. It wasn't a strike for better pay. They just didn't want to die. So what the owners did was to hire Chinese, had them shipped on flatback wagons from Frisco, chained together like convicts. 70 men and 20 women, all dressed in quilted pajama coats and little round hats. I imagine the owners kicked themselves for not thinking of using them sooner, because they had all sorts of advantages over white men. They didn't get drunk and hoorah through town. They didn't trade liquor to the Shoshone or Paiute. They didn't want whores. They didn't even spit tobacco on the sidewalks. Those were just the bonuses, though. The main thing was they'd go as deep as they were told to go, and never mind the sound of the hornfels squeaking and rubbing in the ground all around them. And the shaft could go deeper faster, because it didn't have to be so big. They were a lot smaller than the white miners and could be made to work on their knees. Also, any Chinese miner caught with gold-bearing rock on his person could be shot on the spot, and a few were. Christ, Johnny said. Not much like the old John Wayne movies, Billingsley agreed. Anyway, they were 150 feet down, almost twice as deep as when the white miners threw down their picks, when the cave-in happened. There are all kinds of stories about it. One is that they dug up a Wisin, a kind of ancient earth spirit, and it tore the mine down. Another is that they made the Tommyknockers mad. What are Tommyknockers? David asked. Troublemakers, Johnny said. The underground version of gremlins. Three things, Audrey said from her place at stage right. She was nibbling a pretzel. First, you call that sort of mine work a drift, not a shaft. Second, you drive a driftway, you don't sink it. Third, it was a cave-in, pure and simple. No Tommyknockers, no earth spirits. Rationalism speaks, Johnny said. The spirit of the century. Hurrah! I wouldn't go 10 feet into that kind of ground, Audrey said. No sane person would. And there they were, 150 feet deep, 40 miners, a couple of boss men, at least 5 ponies, all of them chipping and tromping and yelling, doing everything but setting off dynamite. What's amazing is how long the Tommyknockers protected them from their own idiocy. When the cave-in finally did happen, it happened in what should have been a good place, Billingsley resumed. The roof fell in about 60 feet from the adit. He glanced at David. That's what you call the entrance to a mine, son. The miners got up that far from below, and there they were stopped by 20 feet of fallen hornfels, skarn, and Devonian shale. The whistle went off, and the folks from town came up the hill to see what had happened. Even the whores and the gamblers came up. They could hear the Chinamen inside screaming, begging to be dug out before the rest of it came down. Some said they sounded like they were fighting with each other, but no one wanted to go in and start digging. That squealing sound hornfels makes when the ground's uneasy was louder than ever, and the roof was bowed down in a couple of places between the adit and the first rockfall. Could those places have been shored up? Steve asked. Sure, but nobody wanted to take the responsibility for doing it. 2 days later, the president and vice president of Diablo Mines showed up with a couple of mining engineers from Reno. They had a picnic lunch outside the adit while they talked over what to do, my dad told me. Ate it spread out on linen while inside that shaft, pardon me, the drift, not 90 feet from where they were, 40 human souls were screaming in the dark. There had been cave-ins deeper in. Folks said they sounded like something was farting or burping deep down in the earth. But the Chinese were still okay. Still alive, anyway. Behind the first rockfall, begging to be dug out. They were eating the mine ponies by then, I imagine. They'd had no water or light for 2 days. The mining engineers went in, poked their heads in, anyway, and said it was too dangerous for any sort of rescue operation.
So what did they do? Mary asked.
Billingsley shrugged. Set dynamite charges at the front of the mine and brought that down, too. Shut her up.
Are you saying they deliberately buried 40 people alive? Cynthia asked.
42, counting the line boss and the foreman, Billingsley said. The line boss was white, but a drunk and a man known to speak foul language to decent women. No one spoke up for him. The foreman either, far as that goes.
How could they do it?
Most were Chinese, ma'am, Billingsley said, so it was easy.
The wind gusted. The building trembled beneath its rough caress like something alive. They could hear the faint sound of the window in the ladies' room banging back and forth. Johnny kept waiting for it to yawn wide enough to knock over Billingsley's bottle booby trap.
But that's not quite the end of the story, Billingsley said. You know how stuff like this grows in folks' minds over the years.
He put his hands together and wriggled the gnarled fingers. On the movie screen, a gigantic bird, a legendary death kite, seemed to soar. It grows like shadows.
Well, what's the end of it? Johnny asked. Even after all these years, he was a sucker for a good story when he heard one, and this one wasn't bad.
3 days later, two young Chinese fellows showed up at the Lady Day, a saloon which stood about where the broken drum is now. Shot 7 men before they were subdued. Killed 2. One was the mining engineer from Reno, who recommended that the shaft be brought down.
Drift, Audrey said. Quiet, Johnny said, and motioned for Billingsley to go on.
One of the Cooley boys, that's what they were called, was killed in the fracas. Knife in the back, most likely, although the story most people like is that a professional gambler named Harold Brophy flicked a playing card from where he was sitting and cut the man's throat with it. The one still alive was shot in 5 or 6 places. That didn't stop him from taking him out and hanging him the next day, though, after a little sawhorse trial in front of a kangaroo court. I bet he was a disappointment to them. According to the story, he was too crazy to have any idea what was happening. They had chains on his legs and cuffs on his wrists, and still he fought them like a catamount, raving in his own language all the while.
Billingsley leaned forward a little, seeming to stare at David in particular. The boy looked back at him, eyes wide and fascinated.
All of what he said was in the heathen Chinese, but one idea everyone got was that he and his friend had gotten out of the mine and come to take revenge on those who first put them there and then left them there.
Billingsley shrugged.
Most likely they were just two young men from the so-called Chinese encampment south of Ely, men not quite so passive or resigned as the others. By then the story of the cave-in had traveled, and folks in the encampment would have known about it. Some probably had relatives in Desperation. And you have to remember that the one who actually survived the shootout didn't have any English other than cuss words. Most of what they got from him must have come from his gestures, and you know how people love that last twist of the knife in a tall tale. Why, it wasn't a year before folks were saying the Chinese miners were still alive in there, that they could hear them talking and laughing and pleading to be let out, moaning and promising revenge. Would it have been possible for a couple of men to have gotten out? Steve asked. No, Audrey said from the doorway. Billingsley glanced her way, then turned his puffy, red-rimmed eyes on Steve. I reckon, he said. The two of them might have started back down the shaft together, while the rest clustered behind the rockfall. One of them might have remembered a vent or a chimney. Bullshit, Audrey said. It ain't, Billingsley said, and you know it. This is an old volcano field. There's even extrusive porphyry east of town. Looks like black glass with chips of ruby in it. Garnets, they are. And wherever there's volcanic rock, there's shafts and chimneys. The chances of two men ever... It's just a hypothetical case, Mary said soothingly. A way of passing the time, that's all. Hypothetical bullshit, Audrey grumbled, and ate another dubious pretzel. Anyway, that's the story, Billingsley said. Miners buried alive, two get out, both insane by then, and they try to take their revenge. Later on, ghosts in the ground. If that ain't a tale for a stormy night, I don't know what is. He looked across at Audrey, and on his face was a sly, drunk smile. You've been digging up there, miss. You new folks. Haven't come across any short bones, have you? You're drunk, Mr. Billingsley, she said coldly. No, he said. I wish I was, but I ain't. Excuse me, ladies and gents. I get yarning and I get the whizzies. It never damn fails. He crossed the stage, head down, shoulders slumped, weaving slightly. The shadow which followed him was ironic, both in its size and its heroic aspect. His boot heels clumped. They watched him go. There was a sudden flat smacking sound that made them all jump. Cynthia smiled guiltily and raised her sneaker. Sorry, she said. A spider. I think it was one of those fiddleheads. Fiddlebacks, Steve said. Johnny bent down to look, hands planted on his legs just above the knees. Nope. Nope what? Steve asked. Not a fiddleback? Not a singleton, Johnny said. A pair. He looked up, not quite smiling. Maybe, he said, they're Chinese fiddlebacks. 3. Tak, can I want me, Allah? The cougar's eyes opened. She got up. Her tail began switching restlessly from side to side. It was almost time. Her ears cocked forward, twitching, at the sound of someone entering the room behind the white glass. She looked up at it, all rapt attention, a net of measurement and focus. Her leap would have to be perfect to carry her through, and perfection was exactly what the voice in her head demanded. She waited, that small, squalling growl once more rising up from her throat. But now it came out of her mouth, as well as from her nostrils, because her muzzle was wrinkled back to show her teeth. Little by little, she began to tense down on her haunches. Almost time. Almost time. Tak a ten. 4. Billingsley poked his head into the ladies first, and shone his light at the window. The bottles were still in place. He had been afraid that a strong gust of wind might open the window wide enough to knock some of them off the ledge, causing a false alarm,
But that hadn't happened, and now he thought it very unlikely that it would. The wind was dying. The storm, a summer freak the likes of which he had never seen, was winding down. Meantime, he had this problem, this thirst to quench. Except in the last 5 years or so, it had come to seem less and less like a thirst than an itch, as if he had contracted some awful form of poison ivy, a kind that affected one's brain instead of one's skin. Well, it didn't matter, did it? He knew how to take care of his problem, and that was the important thing. And it kept his mind off the rest as well, the madness of the rest. If it had just been danger, someone out of control waving a gun around, that he thought he could have faced, old or not, drunk or not. But this was nothing so cut and dried. The geologist woman kept insisting that it was, that it was all Entragian, but Billingsley knew better. Because Entragian was different now. He told the others that, and Ellen Carver had called him crazy, but how was Entragian different? And why did he, Billingsley, somehow feel that the change in the deputy was important, perhaps vital, to them right now? He didn't know. He should know. It should be as clear as the nose on his face. But these days, when he drank, everything got swimmy, like he was going senile. He couldn't even remember the name of the geologist woman's horse, the mare with the strained leg. "Yes, I can," he murmured. "Yes, I can. It was..." "Was what, you old rummy? You don't know, do you?" "Yes, I do. It was Sally," he cried triumphantly, then walked past the boarded-up fire door and pushed his way into the men's room. He shone his flashlight briefly on the potty. "Sally, that's what it was." He shifted his light to the wall and the smoke-breathing horse which galloped there. He couldn't remember drawing it. He'd been in a blackout, he supposed, but it was indubitably his work, and not bad of its kind. He liked the way the horse looked both mad and free, as if it had come from some other world where goddesses still rode bareback, sometimes leaping whole leagues as they went their wild courses. His memory suddenly clarified a little, as if the picture on the wall had somehow opened his mind. Sally, yes. A year ago, give or take. The rumors that the mine was going to be reopened were just beginning to solidify into acknowledged fact. Cars and trucks had started to show up in the parking lot of the Quonset hut that served as mining headquarters. Planes had started to fly into the airstrip south of town. And he had been told one night, right here in the American West, as a matter of fact, drinking with the boys, that there was a lady geologist living out at the old Reaper place. Young, single, supposedly pretty. Billingsley needed to pee. He hadn't lied, but that wasn't his strongest need right now. There was a filthy blue rag in one of the wash basins, the sort of thing you wouldn't handle without tongs unless you absolutely needed to. The old veterinarian now plucked it up, exposing a bottle of satin smooth, rot-gut whiskey if ever rot-gut whiskey had been bottled, but any port in a storm. He unscrewed the cap and then, holding the bottle in both hands because of the way they were shaking, took a long, deep drink. Napalm slid down his throat and exploded in his gut. It burned all right, but what was that Patty Loveless song that used to play all the time on the radio? "Hurt me, baby, in a real good way." He chased the first gulp with a smaller sip, holding the bottle easier now, the shakes were gone. Then replaced the cap and put the bottle back in the sink. "She called me," he muttered. Outside the window, the cougar's ears flicked at the sound of his voice. She tensed down a little more on her haunches, waiting for him to move closer to where she was, closer to where her leap would bring her. "Woman called me on the phone. Said her horse was a 3-year-old mare named Sally. Yes, sir." He put the rag back over the bottle, not thinking about it, hiding by habit, his mind on that day last summer. He had gone out to the Reaper place, a nice adobe up in the hills, and a fellow from the mine, The black guy, who later became the office receptionist, in fact, had taken him to the horse. He said Audrey had just gotten an urgent call and was going to have to fly off to company headquarters in Phoenix. Then, as they walked to the stable, the black fellow had looked over Billingsley's shoulder and had said,
"He said, 'There she goes now,'" Billingsley murmured.
He had again focused the light on the horse, galloping across the warped tiles, and was staring at it with wide, remembering eyes, his bladder temporarily forgotten.
"And he called to her?"
"Yes, sir." "Hi, Aud," he'd called, and waved. She had waved back. Billingsley had also waved, thinking the stories were right. She was young, and she was good-looking. Not movie star knockout good-looking, but mighty fine for a part of the world where no single woman had to pay for her own drinks if she didn't want to. He had tended her horse, had given the black man a liniment sample to put on, and later she'd come in herself to buy more. Marcia had told him that. He had been over near Washoe, looking after some sick sheep. He'd seen her around town plenty since, though. Not to talk to, no sir, not hardly. They ran with different crowds. But he had seen her eating dinner in the Antlers Hotel or the Owls, once at the jailhouse in Ely. He'd seen her drinking in Bud's Suds or the Drum with some of the other mining folk, rolling dice out of a cup to see who'd pay. In Worrell's Market, buying groceries. At the Conoco, buying gas. In the hardware store one day, buying a can of paint and a brush. Yes, sir, he had seen her around. In a town this small and this isolated, you saw everybody around. Had to. "Why are you running all this through your dumb head?" he asked himself, at last starting toward the potty. His boots gritted in dirt and dust, in grout that had crumbled out from between decaying tiles. He stopped still a little bit beyond aiming and shooting distance, flashlight beam shining on the scuffed tip of one boot while he pulled down his fly. What did Audrey Weiler have to do with Collie? What could she have to do with Collie? He didn't recall ever seeing them together or hearing that they were an item, so it wasn't that. So what was it? And why did his mind keep insisting it had something to do with the day he'd gone out to look at her mare? He hadn't even seen her that day. Well, for a minute, from a distance. He lined himself up with the potty and pulled out the old hog leg. Boy, he had to go. Drink a pint and piss a quart. Wasn't that what they said? Her waving, hurrying for her car, headed for the airstrip, headed for Phoenix. Wearing a business suity kind of rig, sure, because she wasn't going to any Quonset Hut mining headquarters out in the desert. She was going someplace where there was a carpet on the floor and the view was from more than three stories up, going to see the big boys. Nice legs she had. I'm getting on, but I ain't too old to appreciate a pretty knee. Nice. Yes, sir, but... And suddenly it all came together in his mind, not with a click, but with a big, loud kapow. And for a moment, before the cougar uttered her coughing, rising growl, he thought the sound of breaking glass was in his mind, that it was the sound of understanding. Then the growl began, quickly rising to a howl that started him urinating in pure fear. For a moment, it was impossible to associate that sound with anything which had ever walked on the earth. He wheeled, spraying a pinwheel of piss, and saw a dark, green-eyed shape splayed out on the tiles. Bits of broken glass gleamed in the fur on its back. He knew what it was immediately, his mind quickly putting the shape together with the sound in spite of his startlement and terror. The mountain lion, the flashlight showed it to be an extremely large female, raised her face to his and spat at him, revealing two rows of long white teeth. And the 30-06 was back on the stage, leaned up against the movie screen.
"Oh, my God, no," Billingsley whispered, and threw the flashlight past the cougar's right shoulder, missing it intentionally.
When the snarling animal snapped its head around to see what had been thrown at it, Billingsley broke for the door. He ran with his head down, tucking himself back into his pants with the hand that had been holding the flashlight. The cougar loosed another of its screaming, distraught cries, the shriek of a woman being burned or stabbed, deafening in the closed bathroom, and then launched herself at Billingsley, front paws splayed, long claws out. These sank through his shirt and into his back as he groped for the door handle, slicing through scant muscle, flaying him in blood lines that came together like a V. Her big paws snagged in the waistband of his pants and held for a moment, pulling the old man, who was screaming himself now, back into the room. Then his belt broke, and he went tumbling backward, actually landing on top of the cougar. He rolled, hit the glass-littered floor on his side, got to one knee, and then the cougar was on him. She knocked him onto his back and went for his throat. Billingsley got his hand up, and she bit off the side of it. Blood beaded on her whiskers like scarn garnets. Billingsley screamed again and shoved his other hand under the shelf of her chin, trying to push her back, trying to make her let go. He felt her breath on his cheek, pushing like hot fingers. He looked past her shoulder and saw the horse on the wall, his horse, prancing wild and free. Then the cougar lunged forward again, shaking his hand in her jaws, and there was only pain. It filled the world. 5. Cynthia was pouring herself a fresh glass of spring water when the cougar let go its first cry. The sound of it unwound all her nerves and muscles. The plastic bottle slipped from her relaxing fingers, hit the floor between her sneakers, and exploded like a balloon water bomb. She knew the sound for what it was, the yowl of a wildcat, immediately, although she had never heard such a sound outside of a movie theater. And, of course, weird but true, that was still the case. Then it was a man screaming. Tom Billingsley screaming. She turned, saw Steve stare at Marinville, saw Marinville look away, cheeks leaden, lips pressed together but trembling all the same. In that moment, the writer looked weak and lost and oddly female with his long gray hair, like an old woman who's lost track not only of where she is, but of who she is. Still, what Cynthia felt most for Johnny Marinville in that moment was contempt. Steve looked to Ralph, who nodded, grabbed his gun, and ran toward the stage-left opening. Steve caught up with him, and they disappeared that way, running abreast. The old man screamed again, but this time the cry had a gruesome liquid quality, as if he were trying to gargle and scream at the same time, and it didn't last long. The cougar yowled again. Mary went to Steve's boss and held out the shotgun she had up until then barely let go of. "Take it. Go help them." He looked at her, biting his lip. "Listen," he said. "I have lousy night vision. I know how that sounds, but..." The wildcat screamed, the sound so loud it seemed to drill into Cynthia's ears. Goose flesh danced up her back. "Yeah, like a gutless blowhard, that's how it sounds," Mary said, and turned away. That got Marinville moving, but slowly, like someone who has been roused from a deep sleep. Cynthia saw Billingsley's rifle leaning against the movie screen and didn't wait for him. She grabbed the gun and sprinted across the stage, going with it held high over her head like a freedom fighter in a poster. Not because she wanted to look romantic, but because she didn't want to run into something and risk having the gun go off. She might shoot someone up ahead of her. She ran past a couple of dusty chairs standing by what looked like a defunct lighting control panel, then down the narrow hall they had taken to get to the stage in the first place. Brick on one side, wood on the other. A smell of old men with too much time on their hands, and too much jizz, judging from their video library. There was another animal scream, much louder now, but no more noise from the old man. Not a good sign. A door banged open not far ahead, the sound slightly hollow, the sound only a public restroom door can make when it's banged against tile.
So, she thought, the men's or the women's, and it must be the men's, 'cause that's where the toilet is. Look out! Ralph's voice, raised in a near scream. Jesus Christ, Steve! From the cat, there came a kind of spitting roar. There was a thud. Steve yelled, although whether in pain or surprise, she couldn't tell. There were two deafening explosions. The muzzle flashes washed the wall outside the men's room, for a moment revealing a fire extinguisher on which someone had hung a ratty old sombrero. She ducked instinctively, then turned the corner into the bathroom. Ralph Carver was holding the door propped open with his body. The bathroom was lit only by the old man's flashlight, which lay in the corner with the lens pointed at the wall, spraying light up the tiles and kicking back just enough to see by. That faint light and the rolling smoke from Ralph's discharged rifle gave what she was looking at a sultry, hallucinatory quality that made her think of her half a dozen experiments with peyote and mescaline. Billingsley was crawling, dazed, toward the urinals, his head down so far it was dragging on the tiles. His shirt and undershirt had been torn open down the middle. His back was pouring blood. He looked as if he had been flogged by a maniac. In the middle of the floor, a bizarre waltz was going on. The cougar was up on her hind legs, paws on Steve Ames's shoulders. Blood was pouring down her flanks, but she did not seem to be seriously hurt. One of Ralph's shots must have missed her entirely. Cynthia saw that half of the horse on the wall had been blown to smithereens. Steve had his arms crossed in front of his chest. His elbows and forearms were against the cougar's chest. "Shoot it!" he screamed. "For Christ's sake, shoot it again!" Ralph, his face a drawn mask of shadows in the faint light, raised the rifle, aimed it, then lowered it again with an anguished expression, afraid of hitting Steve. The cat shrieked and darted its triangular head forward. Steve snapped his own head back. They tangled drunkenly that way, the cat's claws digging deeper into Steve's shoulders, and now Cynthia could see blood blossoms spreading on the coverall he wore, around the places where the cat's claws were dug in. Its tail was lashing madly back and forth. They did another half turn, and Steve collided with the potty in the middle of the floor. It crashed over on its side, and Steve tottered on the edge of balance, frantically holding off the lunging cougar with his crossed arms. Beyond them, Billingsley had reached the far corner of the men's room, yet continued trying to crawl, as if the wildcat's attack had turned him into some sort of wind-up toy, doomed to go on until he finally ran down. "Shoot this fucking thing!" Steve yelled. He managed to get one foot between the lower part of the potty's frame and its canvas catch bag without falling, but now he was out of backing room. In a moment or two, the cougar would push him over. "Shoot it, Ralph! Shoot it!" Ralph raised the rifle again, eyes wide, gnawing at his lower lip, and then Cynthia was slammed aside. She reeled across the room and caught the middle wash basin in a line of three, just in time to keep herself from smashing face first into the wall-length steel mirror. She turned and saw Merrinville stride into the room with the stock of Mary's gun laid against the inside of his right forearm. His matted gray hair swung back and forth, brushing his shoulders. Cynthia thought she had never seen anyone in her life who looked so terrified, but now that he was in motion, Merrinville didn't hesitate. He socked the shotgun's double muzzle against the side of the animal's head. "Push!" he bellowed, and Steve pushed. The cat's head rocked up and away from him. Its luminous eyes seemed to be lit from within, as if it were not a living thing at all, but some sort of jack-o'-lantern. The rider winced, turned his head slightly away, and pulled both triggers. There was a deafening roar that dwarfed the sound of Carver's rifle. Bright light leaped from the barrel, and then Cynthia smelled frying hair. The cougar fell sideways, its head mostly gone, the fur on the back of its neck smoldering. Steve waved his arms for balance. Merrinville, dazed, made only a token effort to catch him, and Steve, her nice new friend, went sprawling. "Oh, Christ, I think I shit myself,"
Marinville said, almost conversationally, and then, "No, I guess it was just the wind in the willows. Steve, you okay?" Cynthia was on her knees beside him. He sat up, looked around dazedly, and winced as she tentatively pressed a finger to one of the blood blossoms on the shoulder of the coverall.
"I think so."
He was trying to get up. Cynthia put an arm around his waist, braced, hauled.
"Thanks, boss."
"I don't believe it," Marinville said.
He sounded completely natural to Cynthia for the first time since she'd met him, like a man living a life instead of playing a role.
"I don't believe I did it. That woman shamed me into it. Stephen, are you all right?"
"He's got punctures," Cynthia said, "but never mind that now. We've got to help the old guy." Mary came in with Marinville's gun, the one that was unloaded, held up by one shoulder. Her hands were wrapped around the end of the barrel. To Cynthia, her face looked almost eerily composed. She surveyed the scene, even more dreamlike now, not just tinged with gun smoke, but hazed with it, and then hurried across the room toward Billingsley, who made two more tired efforts to crawl into the wall, and then collapsed from the knees upward, his face going last, first tilting and then sliding down the tiles. Ralph reached for Steve's shoulder, saw the blood there, and settled for gripping his arm high up on the bicep.
"I couldn't," he said. "I wanted to, but I couldn't. After the first two rounds, I was afraid of hitting you instead of it. When you finally got turned around so I could make a side shot, Marinville was there."
"It's okay," Steve said. "All's well that ends well."
"I owed it to him," the writer said with a winning quarterback expansiveness Cynthia found rather nauseating. "If it hadn't been for me, he wouldn't have been here in the..."
"Get over here," Mary said, her voice cracking. "Jesus Christ, oh man, he's bleeding so bad." The four of them gathered around Mary and Billingsley. She had gotten him onto his back, and Cynthia winced at what she saw. One of the old geezer's hands was mostly gone, all the fingers but the pinky chewed to stubs, but that wasn't the worst. His lower neck and shoulder had been flayed open. Blood was spilling out in freshets. Yet he was awake, his eyes bright and aware.
"Skirt," he whispered hoarsely. "Skirt!"
"Don't try to talk, old-timer," Marinville said.
He bent, scooped up the flashlight, and trained it on Billingsley. It made what had looked bad enough in the shadows even worse. There was a pond of blood beside the old guy's head. Cynthia didn't understand how he could still be alive.
"I need a compress," Mary said. "Don't just stand there. Help me. He's going to die if we don't stop the bleeding right now."
"Too late, babe," Cynthia thought, but didn't say. Steve saw what looked like a rag in one of the sinks and grabbed it. It turned out to be a very old shirt with Joe Camel on it. He folded the shirt twice, then handed it to Mary. She nodded, folded it once more, then pressed it against the side of Billingsley's neck.
"Come on," Cynthia said, taking Steve's arm. "Back on stage. If there's nothing else, I can at least wash those out with water from the bar. There's plenty on the bottom ship."
"No," the old man whispered. "Stay. Got to hear this."
"You can't talk," Mary said. She pushed harder on the side of his neck with the makeshift compress. The shirt was already darkening. "You'll never stop bleeding if you talk." He rolled his eyes toward Mary.
"Too late for doctoring." His voice was hoarse. "Dying."
"No, you're not. That's ridiculous."
"Dying," he repeated,
and moved violently beneath her hands. His torn back squelched on the tiles, a sound that made Cynthia feel nauseated.
"Get down here, all of you, close, and listen to me."
Steve glanced at Cynthia. She shrugged, then the two of them knelt beside the old man's leg, Cynthia shoulder to shoulder with Mary Jackson. Marinville and Carver leaned in from the sides.
"He shouldn't talk," Mary said, but she sounded doubtful.
"Let him say what he needs to," Marinville said. "What is it, Tom?"
too short for business,
Billingsley whispered. He was looking up at them, begging them with his eyes to understand. Steve shook his head.
I'm not getting you.
Billingsley wet his lips.
Only seen her once before, in a dress. That's why it took me too long to figure out what was wrong.
A startled expression had come over Mary's face. That's right. She had a meeting with the controller. He comes all the way from Phoenix to hear her report on something important, something that means big bucks, and she puts on a dress so short she'll be flashing her pants at him every time she crosses her legs?
I don't think so.
Beads of sweat ran down Billingsley's pale, stubbly cheeks like tears.
Feel so stupid, he wheezed. Not all my fault, though. Nope. Didn't know her to talk to. Wasn't there the one time she came into the office to pick up more liniment. Always saw her at a distance, and out here women mostly wear jeans. But I had it. I did. Had it and then got drinking and lost track of it again.
He looked at Mary.
The dress would have been all right when she put it on. Do you see? Do you understand?
What's he talking about? Ralph asked. How could it be all right when she put it on and too short for a business meeting later?
Taller, the old man whispered.
Marinville looked at Steve. What was that? It sounded like he said,
Taller,
Billingsley said. He enunciated the word carefully, then began to cough. The folded shirt Mary held against his neck and shoulder was now soaked. His eyes rolled back and forth among them. He turned his head to one side, spat out a mouthful of blood, and the coughing fit eased. Dear God, Ralph said. She's like Entragian? Is that what you're saying? That she's like the cop?
Yes. No, Billingsley whispered. Don't know for sure. Would have seen that right away, but...
Mr. Billingsley, do you think she might have caught a milder dose of whatever the cop has? Mary asked. He looked at her gratefully and squeezed her hand. Marinville said,
She's sure not bleeding out like the cop. Or not where we can see it, Ralph said. Not yet, anyway.
Billingsley looked past Mary's shoulder.
Where? Where?
He began coughing again and wasn't able to finish, but he didn't need to. A startled look passed among them, and Cynthia turned around. Audrey wasn't there. Neither was David Carver. Chapter 4 1 The thing which had been Ellen Carver, taller now, still wearing the badge but not the Sam Brown belt, stood on the steps of the municipal building, staring north along the sand-drifted street, past the dancing blinker light. It couldn't see the movie theater, but knew where it was. More, it knew what was going on inside the movie theater. Not all, but enough to anger it. The cougar hadn't been able to shut the drunk up in time, but at least she had drawn the rest of them away from the boy. That would have been fine, except the boy had eluded its other emissary as well, at least temporarily. Where had he gone? It didn't know, couldn't see, and that was the source of its anger and fear. He was the source, David Carver, the goddamned shitting prey boy. It should have killed him when it had been inside the cop and had had the chance. Should have shot him right on the steps of his own damned motorhome and left him for the buzzards. But it hadn't, and it knew why it hadn't. There was a blankness about Master Carver. A shielded quality. That was what had saved little Prey Boy earlier. Its hands clenched at its sides. The wind gusted, blowing Ellen Carver's short, red-gold hair out like a flag. Why is he even here, someone like him? Is it an accident? or was he sent? Why are you here? Are you an accident? Were you sent? Such questions were useless. It knew its purpose, tak Allah, and that was enough. It closed its Ellen eyes, focusing inward at first, but only for a second. It was unpleasant. This body had already begun to fail. It wasn't a matter of decay so much as intensity. The force inside it, Kandalach, heart of the unformed, was literally pounding it to pieces, and its replacements had escaped the pantry. Because of Prey Boy. Shitting Prey Boy. It turned its gaze outward, not wanting to think about the blood trickling down this body's thighs, or the way its throat had begun to throb, or the way that, when it scratched Ellen's head, large clumps of Ellen's red hair had begun to come away under its nails. It sent its gaze into the theater instead. What it saw, it perceived in overlapping, sometimes contradictory images, all fragmentary. It was like watching multiple TV screens reflected in a heap of broken glass. Primarily, the eyes of the infiltrating spiders were what it was looking through, but there were also flies, cockroaches, rats peering out of holes in the plaster, and bats hanging from the auditorium's high ceiling. These latter were projecting strange, cool images that were actually echoes. It saw the man from the truck, the one who had come into town on his own, and his skinny little girlfriend leading the others back to the stage. The father was shouting for the boy, but the boy wasn't answering. The writer walked to the edge of the stage, cupped his hands around his mouth, and screamed Audrey's name. And Audrey, where was she? No way of telling, for sure. It couldn't see through her eyes as it saw through the eyes of the lesser creatures. She had gone after the boy, certainly. Or had she already found him? It thought not. Not yet, anyway. That it would have sensed. It pounded one hand against Ellen's thigh in anxiety and frustration, leaving an instant bruise like a rotten place on the skin of an apple, then shifted focus once more. No, it saw. They were not all on stage. The prismatic quality of what it was seeing had misled it. Mary was still with old Tom. If Ellen could get to her while the others were preoccupied with Audrey and David, it might solve all sorts of problems later on. It didn't need her now. This current body was still serviceable and would continue so for a while. But it wouldn't do to have it fail at a crucial moment. It would be better, safer, if... The image that came was of a spider web with many silk-wrapped flies dangling from it, flies that were drugged but not dead. "Emergency rations," the old one whispered in Ellen Carver's voice, in Ellen Carver's language. "Knick-knack, paddywhack, give the dog a bone." And Mary's disappearance would demoralize the rest, take away any confidence they might have gained from escaping, finding shelter, and killing the cougar. It had thought they might manage that last. They were armed, after all, and the cougar was a physical being, Sarx and Soma and Numa, not some goblin from the metaphysical wastes. But who could have imagined that pretentious old windbag doing it? He called the other one on a phone he had. You didn't guess that, either. You didn't know until the yellow truck came. Yes, and missing the phone had been a lapse, something right in the front of Marinville's mind that it should have picked up easily. But it didn't hold that against itself. At that point, its main goals had been to get the old fool jugged and replace Entragian's body before it could fall apart completely. It had been sorry to lose Entragian, too. Entragian had been strong. If it meant to take Mary, there would never be a better time than now. And perhaps while it did that, Audrey would find the boy and kill him. That would be wonderful. No worries then.
no sneaking around. It could replace Ellen with Mary and pick the rest off at its leisure. And later, when its current and limited supply of bodies ran out, snatch more travelers from the highway? Perhaps. And when people, curious people, came to town to see what the hell was going on in desperation, what then? It would cross that bridge when it got to the river. It had little memory and even less interest in the future. For now, getting Mary up to China Pit would be enough. Tack went down the steps of the municipal building, glanced at the police car, then crossed the street on foot. No driving, not for this errand. Once it reached the far sidewalk, it began to run in long strides, sand spurting up from beneath sneakers which had been sprung out to the sides by feet which were now too big for them. 2. On stage, Audrey could hear them still calling David's name, and hers. Soon they would spread out and begin to search. They had guns, which made them dangerous. The idea of being killed didn't bother her. Not much, anyway, not as it had at first. But the idea that it might happen before she was able to kill the boy did. To the cougar, the voice of the thing from the earth had been like a fishhook. In Audrey Weiler's mind, it was like an acid-coated snake, winding its way into her, melting the personality of the woman who had been here before it, even as it enfolded her. This melting sensation was extremely pleasant, like eating some sweet, soft food. It hadn't been at first. At first, it had been dismaying, like being overwhelmed by a fever. But as she collected more of the cantas, like a child participating in a scavenger hunt, that feeling had passed. Now she only cared about finding the boy. Tack, the unformed one, did not dare approach him, so she must do it in Tack's place. At the top of the stairs, the woman who had been 5'7" on the day Tom Billingsley had first glimpsed her stopped, looking around. She should have been able to see nothing. There was only one window, and the only light that fell through its filthy panes came from the blinker and a single weak street lamp in front of Bud Suds. But her vision had improved greatly with each canta she had found or been given. Now she had almost the vision of a cat, and the littered hallway was no mystery to her. The people who had hung out in this part of the building had been far less neatness-minded than Billingsley and his crew. They had smashed their bottles in the corners instead of collecting them, and instead of fantasy fish or smoke-breathing horses, the walls were decorated with broad magic marker pictographs. One of these, as primitive as any cave drawing, showed a horned and misshapen child hanging from a gigantic breast. Beneath it was scrawled a little couplet. "Little bitty baby Smitty, I seen you bite your mommy's titty." Paper trash, fast food sacks, candy wrappers, potato chip bags, empty cigarette packs, and condom envelopes had drifted along both sides of the hall. A used rubber hung from the knob of the door marked manager, pasted there in its own long-dried fluids like a dead snail. The door to the manager's office was on her right. Across from it was one marked janitor. Up ahead on the left was another door, this one unmarked, and then an arch with a word written on it in ancient black paint half flaked away. Even her eyes couldn't make out what the word was, at least from this distance, but a step or two closer and it came clear. Balcony. The archway had been boarded up, but at some point the boards had been pulled away and heaped to either side of it. Hanging from the top of the arch was a mostly deflated sex doll with blonde Arnell hair, a red-ringed hole of a mouth, and a bald, rudimentary vagina. There was a noose around its neck, the coils dark with age. Also around its neck, hanging against the doll's sagging plastic bosom, was a hand-lettered sign which looked as if it might have been made by a hard-working first grader. It was decorated with a red-eyed skull and crossbones at the top. "Don't come out here," it said. Ready to fall down. I'm serious.
Across from the balcony was an alcove which had once probably held a snack bar. At the far end of the hall were more steps going up into